Claire, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, The Micro Power of Radio. I'm going to bring you excerpts of a conference presentation I did this past weekend, along with John Anderson, Jane Needham, and Josh Gumiella. You all want to stay tuned. So over the weekend of September 7th through 9th, I attended an interesting academic conference called Global Fusion, which is sponsored by Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, the University of Texas, Purdue University, Calumet, and Ohio University. And it's a conference which is intended to promote academic excellence in international intercultural communication studies worldwide, bringing together scholars, professionals interested in mass communications, journalism, comparative broadcasting, diplomacy, transnational communication, advertising, new technology, media economics and privatization, cultural effects, visual communication, media and international law, and global dialogues in search of peace. Whew. I was invited along with John Anderson, who you hear often on this program. In fact, you heard him here last week, who is also a doctoral candidate at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. To participate in a panel discussion on micro radio, its potentials, as well as some of just the nuts and bolts as a opportunity to bring some practicality to the proceedings while also looking at some of the larger impacts of this sort of radio. I was very honored to share the panel with Jay Needham, who is a professor of sonic arts down at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and its College of Mass Communication and Media Arts. Also joining us was Josh Gumiella, who is a MFA student, a Master's of Fine Arts student in that college. And I have to say, they're doing some really interesting, creative, and innovative things down at Southern Illinois University in the College of Mass Communication and Media Arts, really trying to bridge together a lot of traditional broadcasting education, and then, of course, critical communications education. John Downing is a professor there who published a book called Radical Media, which has recently been updated. He's been on the program before here, really looking at the organizations that create radical media, what makes them tick, and what are the problems they face in our modern capitalist media environment. And then bring that together with artists and bring that to people who are taking a very broad approach to media art. So both in regards to sound, in regards to video, whether it's documentary, whether it's something that is more properly looked upon as fine art, bringing it all together. Jay Needham, who shared the panel with us, professor of sonic arts, has worked with various types of micro power transmitters in creating art in what he calls Hertzian space. So they gave me permission to record the panel, and it was a fairly long presentation, which we peppered with a lot of questions, very interactive with the audience, which we didn't have very well mic'd. It's hard for me to bring you that part of it. And this was held at Westport Sheraton on the western edge of St. Louis. And without further ado, I will simply go to the beginning of this presentation on Micro Power Radio.
Let me turn my name tag around because I'm wearing a very important T-shirt that says the FCC can have my transmitter when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers, which is something that I actually got from someone who used to run a radio station in Austin, Texas, called Free Radio Austin. And this picture here, I don't know if you can see it through the projector, is of an actual FCC agent that came and busted the radio station. So it's kind of an important shirt for me, and I thought it would be appropriate for today's panel. This is Micro Radio, Tactical Overview and Deployment Opportunities. My name is John Anderson. I am a doctoral candidate at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I used to be a commercial radio journalist from 1994 until the year 2000, during which time I also started a website where I started cataloging and researching ideas of unlicensed broadcasting and the U.S. micro radio movement, which led to the development of low-power FM radio. And I have been continually writing on this for 10 years now. The website is diymedia.net. That's DIY as in do-it-yourself media.net.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jay Needham. I teach mostly sound art courses, sound and moving image classes at SIU Carbondale in the Department of Radio and Television. I'm an artist. I'm trained as a visual artist primarily, but also came out of a kind of a busted up classical composition program that allowed me to experiment a great deal. So I continue on as a composer, documentarian, and music maker as well, but also a radio maker and player in the Hertzian space. And so I'm really excited to be here to talk, hopefully with all of you as well, and dialogue a bit. But I work as a kind of a maker and breaker of things too, so hi-fi and lo-fi technologies, and that's kind of the latter of which is what we are kind of focusing on today. And I'm just going to toss it over to Josh.
Thanks. I'm Josh Gumiela. I'm currently pursuing my MFA at SIUC. I really like sound, and several years ago I started sort of teaching myself basic electronics because I wanted to build some things, and of course in the process of figuring out what to build, the little FM transmitter kit came along. So I had some fun playing with that and eventually decided to actually try setting up a micro radio station, which I did, running it like 50 milliwatts, never got to throw the signal really far, but had a lot of fun, broadcasting some of my own material and a lot of friends' material, found sound and field recordings and things of that sort.
Don't worry, it's just computer
noise. And that's about it for me.
Hi, I'm Paul Riesmandel. I built my first radio transmitter when I was about 10 and continued to build them in high school, mostly finding ways that you could salvage radios and turn them into very tiny, low-power transmitters. Professionally, I work in audio and video for the University of Illinois, but I've never left radio. So I've been involved in community radio for about 13 years now at WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Was involved in college radio, but never lost the bug for radio that is not licensed, and think that there needs to be a large place for radio that is not explicitly licensed by the state. I started getting back into pirate radio after college sometime around 1994, 1995, and I realized through the power of the internet that there were other people doing the same thing all around the country and all around the world, and started taking up more as a research topic rather than active engagement at that point. Started doing a radio program on community radio WFT where I was taking up all of grassroots and independent media, but I have always had a specific emphasis on micro radio and on pirate radio, and that radio show continues today. I do it. It's called Media Geek. It's a weekly half hour, and it airs on WFT, but I've got it on about 10 or 11 other mostly low power stations and also a couple of unlicensed stations around North America.
Radio is probably the most inexpensive way to reach a large audience as opposed to trying to do television or something like that. And with, just the widespread use of radio receivers, you really can reach a lot of people at a very low cost.
Now, a little bit about how FM works and why FM is so important and why FM is so cheap and so effective in this type of broadcasting. First of all, it's very compact. The stations that are right above us here are operating on the AM band. AM wavelengths, the waves that the station actually broadcasts, are huge. They're measured in hundreds of feet, typically. So the size of the antenna that you need to generate an AM signal is hundreds of feet. Usually these are large towers. They can be simply long wires. But you need a lot of space to put up an antenna to broadcast on the AM dial. FM signals are on a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which we have a nice chart of, which we can show. They don't take as much space for the antenna. So the antenna is very compact. You can put it somewhere in a relatively small location and broadcast with it. So all of this equipment fits into, you know, a duffel bag, and you can carry it with you and set it up wherever you want. Now, the two factors that determine how far an FM signal gets out are power and height of the antenna. And height of the antenna is most important on the FM dial because FM is a line of sight medium, meaning the signal goes out towards the horizon, and if an antenna, a radio antenna like that one, can see the transmitting antenna, it will be able to pick up the signal. But if there is an obstruction in the way, like a hill or a mountain or a skyscraper, there is a chance that that antenna will not be able to pick up the signal. So if you want to increase the range of your FM station on the cheap, don't buy a larger transmitter. As a rule of thumb, you have to increase the power four times to double the range of your FM radio station. But if you increase the height of the antenna above the surrounding terrain, you can get out a lot farther with the same amount of power. Now we want to talk a little bit about the history of unlicensed broadcasting, because it's something that's actually been talked about, especially in the U.S. context, only within the last 10 or 15 years, but unlicensed broadcasting actually has a history that goes all the way back to the beginning of radio.
Paul? Yeah, right. I mean, Marconi didn't have a license. The very first broadcasters were all unlicensed inherently. At that point, the United States government and the governments around the world didn't really know what to do about this thing we call the electromagnetic spectrum, how it would be used, what it would be used for, and who could use it. Radio is born of hobbyists and experimenters and inventors. It's actually born more of universities than it is corporations. And it wasn't until AT&T realized that you might be able to sell commercials on a radio station did we get what we now call radio, commercial radio. Certainly not a system which was the only one that could have happened. It's not necessarily the logical one that has happened, but is the one that has happened largely because the authorities which could establish a domain over the electromagnetic spectrum, the governments, decided that was one of the best uses for the spectrum. So as a result, pirate radio has a very long history. As long as there have been transmitters, there's been someone using one without a license. But as a movement of sorts, you find that unlicensed radio really gets its start in the 1960s, and it gets its start in Europe. And the reason why is that the radio dials of Europe looked a lot different than the radio dials of the United States. State broadcasting was the predominant form. So Radio Netherlands, the BBC, Deutsche Welle. There were not private radio stations. There were not necessarily private university stations, private community stations, private commercial stations. And so the only culture and news that was propagated is that which was accepted by the establishment. Notably absent from the dial were things like rock and roll, or blues, or jazz, except maybe some established forms. And so that first wave of pirate radio was really entrepreneurial in its outlook to bring these new sounds to places like the Netherlands and England, and also take a page from the book of the United States and to sell commercials and to make money while doing it. So a couple of prominent stations is Radio Veronica, which set up offshore in the North Sea on a ship. On the AM dial, but it's actually it's a pretty good way to go. You kind of use the water as part of your antenna because it conducts electricity, and started broadcasting commercial rock and roll radio to Northern Europe. In 1964, on Easter Sunday, Radio Caroline did the same thing for the UK. That's where we get this notion of calling it pirate radio, because they were actually using ships parked offshore and playing a game of cat and mouse with the authorities, who were taken off guard because at that point, unlike the United States and like Canada, I mean, they weren't used to having a facility for handing out radio licenses you just had the BBC, you just had Radio Netherlands, that's it. So it was sort of a force and a force of change, because it's simply because of that pirate activity that you started to see the licensing of privately run stations, non-state stations in a lot of these countries. The idea got taken up in the 1970s in Italy by the Autonomia movement. And they were really the first micro broadcasters. So they were the first ones to move it from the AM dial, where, as John mentioned, you need these large antennas, you need a lot of real estate, fairly large transmitters, and to take up the idea of doing it on the FM dial, and to instead start using little transmitters that you could place all over the place. It was an explicitly anarchist and explicitly anti-fascist movement. Again, you know, in that time in the 70s, very tight grip on radio broadcasting by the state in Italy. And this was seen as a way to break free of that particular restriction and to be able to do so in a less traceable sort of way, instead of having a ship offshore, which would be pretty easy to find if you have thousands of little transmitters in the cities, in the countryside, whether you're in Florence or whether you're in Rome or in Tuscany out somewhere, much harder to track down and much easier to put up a new one when one goes down, and really working with people's movements. A man named Tetsuo Kogawa in Japan was inspired by this and took this idea back to Japan in the 1970s and started what was called mini FM. So we started working with transmitters much more like what Josh has here rather than this, and started giving people instructions on how to build little tiny FM transmitters, taking advantage of the unique geography of a place like Tokyo. Extremely dense, extremely tall. And so if you get a little 50 milliwatt transmitter and you live in the 15th story of a building, you can broadcast for several blocks. And his idea was to also use that as a form to bring people together. So he would throw what we'll call radio parties. So you put this transmitter on the air, and then you tell everyone to come visit you. He was slipping sort of through the cracks in the sidewalk in Japan, because there was no regulation on the books to say that you couldn't have a transmitter running at 50 milliwatts, whereas in the United States there are such restrictions. So it was sort of slipping through, again, something where the authorities never thought, outside of NHK, that anyone would have transmitters. And that really became an enormously popular movement, to the extent to which music stores or, you know, schools would be putting up mini FM transmitters and using them as a way to bring people together. In turn, that influenced people back here in the United States. Starting out in the 80s, two men took it up in 1985, someone called Black Rose in Fresno, California, and Ibana Kantako in Springfield, Illinois, so not very far from here, took up this idea of low-power FM transmission to put stations on, which they called Black Liberation Radio, working much more for the cause of civil rights and radical civil rights, as well as human rights. And sort of brought it back here, and again, using these same means. Ibana Kantako was working out of the projects, the housing projects of Springfield, and was using this as a way to provide a voice for their tenants' rights association. Because he realized a lot of typical ways of organizing, printing up newsletters, wasn't working. They couldn't have meetings because there's no meeting space, and the rules of the projects were such that you weren't allowed to have parties, you weren't allowed to have lots of people gathering in one space. That would violate the terms of your lease and you'd be kicked out. That's word of mouth.
And the interesting thing about Ibana Kantako too is that he was blind.
Yeah,
Ibana Kantako is a blind
man.
So things like running a newspaper were completely irrelevant to him because he couldn't see. Mm-hmm. One of the other main reasons why he decided to start his radio station was, at the time there was an incredible epidemic of police brutality in Springfield, Illinois, against the African American community. Mm-hmm. The final resting place of Abraham Lincoln. Promulgator of the Emancipation Proclamation, yet people were getting beat down crazy in Springfield. People were getting killed in Springfield. And so what he did is he used his tenants' rights activism and other connections within his community to start publicizing the idea of putting a radio station on the air. And one of the first things that the radio station did was broadcast from the streets. So he encouraged people to take small tape recorders with them when they went out somewhere and ran an errand or went to a party or something like that. And if they saw the police harassing young black men or women, to tape them or to call the radio station and give a live report of what was happening on the air. Or people that had actually been victimized or brutalized by the police were encouraged to come into the radio station and give their stories of what happened to them. And, surprisingly enough, instances of police brutality following the debut of Black Liberation Radio plummeted in Springfield. And it wasn't because Springfield's traditional media started picking up on this story. It wasn't because Springfield's city council decided to pick up the issue because there was this microwatt transmitter. It was because there was actually a public outlet for the exposure of police brutality, and the police department itself had changed its ways, and they knew it. And they harassed Mbana Kantako. But Mbana Kantako's whole idea about unlicensed broadcasting was, when they made these rules, we were sitting in the back of the bus somewhere. So why should we follow rules that we had no opportunity to create, that allow for no input for us to actually access the airwaves? This is not just an issue of racial equality or racial parity or racial justice. It's a human rights issue. And he was one of the first people in the United States to explicitly politicize the act of unlicensed broadcasting in the way we think of it in the modern context. Anybody else have anything?
Yeah, if I can just kind of jump in with that too, is I think that that's something that the space of radio, kind of a Hertzian space of public imagination. I mean, this reinvention of radio, or always looking into its future, is something that's it's been there since people started working with it. I mean, right, Brecht wrote about it, Arnheim wrote about it. Klebnikov imagined that space of imagination as a radio of the future, but it always has a root and a return to a sense of social movement or purpose and community. I think also it's with Kogawa. I always think there's a nice parallel with mini FM and micro FM in the United States, mm-hmm. Sort of paralleling the Fluxus activity. That was happening in, there's my pun, at happenings, right? That become a part of those social spaces where gallery spaces and public events are being used, in kind of interesting and revolutionary ways. And then, of course, radio gets to just be a part of that because of the space it can occupy and extend as well. Anything you wanted to add about some of the 80s history?
Well, and that's, I mean, it was through these two folks in the United States were also working, if not directly with, but sort of inspired by and around folks like Stephen Dunifer, who was an activist in the Berkeley area, Berkeley, California, who put on the air Free Radio Berkeley. And as part of his role, he not only put a station on the air, but also set up a shop to build transmitters and to sell kits and to start becoming a sort of Johnny Appleseed of low-power transmitters, with the idea that we can overwhelm the system, that the ability for the FCC to ferret out low-power unlicensed transmitters is pretty limited, because these are the same guys who have to ferret out taxi cab two-ways and everything else. We put thousands of transmitters on. There's no way that they can't do with the system. And part of it was again, explicitly political, saying, well, you won't license us. I can't get a license for a one-watt transmitter. You simply won't give us one. And so as a result, you're cutting us out because we can't afford 10,000 and 20,000 watts. And so we're going to do it anyway, strict civil disobedience.
Yeah, and as such, Dunifer is vehemently anti-LPFM because there has been a migration of microbroadcasters sort of to some of the LPFMs that have been set up. But, he doesn't buy into that because he thinks that it's just sort of the FCC trying to appease, us with basically more legislation, more control.
But yet, I mean, in a way, the idea worked, whether it worked out the way he wanted it to, because it was the pressure of micro radio stations going on the air
throughout
the 1990s in large quantities in cities everywhere that pushed the Clinton era FCC to take up the idea of licensing low power transmitters, what we now call LPFM, and they're all over the country at this point, stations operating at 100 watts as explicitly commercial radio. Community radio stations. But nevertheless, it's something which has been continuously and very, with a lot of money behind it, opposed by the National Association of Broadcasters, which is roughly the industry association for most of commercial radio. And that was part of a presentation at the 7th Annual Global Fusion Conference on September 8, 2007. You just heard me speaking. Bob Riesmandel here, your host of Media Geek, along with John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, a frequent guest here on Media Geek, a fellow enthusiast and follower and researcher of micropower and pirate radio and all sorts of radio as well. He is also a doctoral candidate at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You also heard from Jay Needham, who's a professor of sonic arts at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and Josh Gumiello, who is a Master's of Fine Arts student at Southern Illinois University there at Carbondale, where they have a very interesting interdisciplinary MFA program going on. Really innovative communications, thought, thinking, and action happening at Southern Illinois University, just a short 4 hours south here of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, where Media Geek is produced. I may get more of that posted to the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. I'll let you know. You'll see it pop up there so you can hear more about it without just tuning into the program. A couple of notes here I want to make before the time is up. Coming up on September 20th, the FCC will be in Chicago having a hearing on media ownership. It's going to be held at the Operation Push National Headquarters at Dr. King's Workshop, 930 East 50th Street, that's the corner of South Drexel Boulevard in Chicago. Zip is 60615. That is from 4 to 11 p.m. on that day, Thursday. I think a lot of focus is going to be on minority ownership of media because Chicago has one of the lowest percentages of minority ownership of any major market in the United States, even while the minority population is quite large. In preparation, a bunch of groups in Chicago are holding some workshops in the coming week on the issue of media ownership. So if it's something you're interested in and you are able to be in the Chicago area, there's a whole bunch starting off on the 16th, Sunday at 7 p.m. Chicago Media Action will be sponsoring a workshop at 3411 West Diversey in Chicago. On Monday, the 17th, the Westside NAACP will be hosting one at 6:30 at 3559 West Arlington in Chicago. I've got a list of all the workshops at the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. Also, on Wednesday night, the 19th of September, it's a media reform party with music legend John Langford and DJ Sean Doe spinning local hip-hop. That's at Delilah's at 2771 North Lincoln Avenue on Wednesday the 19th from 8 to 11 p.m. It's sponsored by the Future of Music Coalition. Apparently a $5 donation at the door gets you a free drink. All money raised will go to support volunteer efforts at the FCC hearing on September 20th. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around
around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.